Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a recording of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Pentecost Sunday, May 27th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons. Now, when you make your gift, please indicate whether you want a downloadable version or a CD of these sermons. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the Easter season.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It is no coincidence that when things finally come to a head with Jesus' opponents, the religious authorities in Jerusalem in particular, they really are the temple authorities. It's the establishment, not just a religious establishment, an establishment around the holy place of God, that Jesus, upon entering the holy city, we would say on his triumphal entry, he goes to the temple. And according to several of the gospel writers, he does something there that puts him on a collision course with those authorities, something that might even be considered, well, is considered blasphemous. We're going to talk about the archaeological evidence surrounding those temple authorities and Jesus' confrontation with them in part four of our five-part daily series on biblical archaeology. Joining us to do so on this Thursday afternoon, April the 26th, Dr. Craig Evans. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada and author of several books, including his latest publication titled Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Why does it happen there, in the temple, that this, what will prove to be for Jesus, fatal confrontation with the religious authorities, why does it happen in that place and time?
Well, the temple precincts, and it's a very large area. It's about 500 meters north to south, about 300 meters east to west. It's not a perfect rectangle, but it's a very large area. And in the center of it, of course, is the sanctuary itself. But a lot of people don't realize that it's a complex. It's like a huge quad or mall or something, and a whole bunch of buildings. Well, that particular area, that area was under the direct authority and control of the ruling priesthood, and the Romans respected that. So Jesus could act up and do whatever he wanted, demonstrate, talk anywhere else in Jerusalem or outside of Jerusalem. But if he takes his message that is critical of the ruling priests into the precinct, he is in their backyard. And there are warning signs, in fact, chiseled in stone, portions of which we have since found, that warn Gentiles not to get too close to the sanctuary. If you do that, you're dead. I think all of that just shows the authority that the ruling priests have. And so Jesus does two things. He goes into the precincts and he criticizes the ruling priests as being avaricious, greedy, and oppressive. And then secondly, he warns that, and the implication is, if they don't change, destruction will befall them and their precious sanctuary. And man, that is really, really bad from a political and a religious point of view in antiquity. That's a very severe, threatening criticism. I'm not at all surprised they react the way they do and seek his death.
So you say that he actually kind of speaks their language. When he says those famous words about my house shall be a house of prayer for all nations, yet you have turned it into a den of thieves, I paraphrase, he is drawing upon two key events in the history of that temple or its predecessor.
Oh, yes, he is. There are two Old Testament passages that he has very, very briefly quoted. The house of prayer for all the nations, that comes right out of Isaiah 56. It's part of an oracle that recalls Solomon's prayer of dedication. Remember, King Solomon built the first temple. He dedicated it, and part of his prayer of dedication is that Gentiles would be welcome. They could come. They could bring their gifts. If they come with a sincere heart and present their gifts at the temple, their prayers will be heard. And then Jesus says, instead of doing that, instead of making the temple this house of prayer for all the Gentiles, instead you've transformed it. Literally, the Greek reads, you have transformed it into a cave of robbers. And that comes right out of Jeremiah 7, part of Jeremiah's criticism of the priesthood of his time and warning that the temple would be destroyed. So just in that pithy little one or two sentences, summing up the whole of Jesus' teaching, you can see why the ruling priests felt so threatened. I mean, they're criticized. Jesus is implying that they have utterly failed in their duty. And so the temple establishment, far from being a spiritual lighthouse to the world, which is what Solomon envisioned, it has, in fact, become a cave where robbers hang out and plan their criminal activities and divide up the spoil, what they have stolen, and so on. And, I mean, I can just easily imagine ruling priests cringing at these words, hearing that, boiling over with anger, and beginning to talk among themselves, how do we silence this man? How do we put him away? Because, you know, they know the truth of it. Many people, in fact, agree. And so, you know, they worry that Jesus' words could be like lighting a match and causing a fire, and they want to silence him the sooner the better, hopefully before the Passover celebration arrives.
So this really shines light on kind of the political intrigue that's recorded by several of the Gospels in and around this time with regard to these ruling priests, how they considered Jesus not only a threat to their personal reputations, but even more seriously, a potential instigator of Rome's discipline of the people.
Very definitely. And, of course, 40 years later, or not even 40 years later, in the year 66, that, in fact, happens. And so it's not simply a purely theoretical worry that, oh, well, that might happen. I think they were trying to keep a lid down on a boiling pot, and they were afraid that that lid was just going to get blown off. And it does 30-some years later. There's something else that I think we need to make clear. When I say ruling priests, you'll hear me say that. There are priests, and then there are priests. The village priests are not the priests Jesus is critical with. In other words, the vast majority of the priests, Jesus has no problem with them. We're talking about a very small group of powerful, wealthy people called ruling priests. They would number just a few dozen families. In fact, four families are well remembered in the rabbinic writings. And Caiaphas, the son-in-law of Annas, that's one of the families right there. In fact, it was the most powerful of these four families. So when I say Jesus was critical of the ruling priests, I'm not talking about the vast majority of priests who were perfectly honest, did their jobs properly wherever they were located. Many of them, of course, would come to Jerusalem and participate in the annual Passover festival. Jesus is not talking about them. He's talking about Caiaphas, Annas, and their families, a small number of ruling priests, and those are the ones who move against Jesus and ultimately hand him over to the Roman authorities.
You say, before we get on to the artifacts themselves, you say that Jesus compounds this by, at least in Mark's account of it, telling this, or perhaps even retelling, this parable of the tenants in the vineyard in a way that isn't generally applicable to all the people, but particularly applicable only to these ruling priests. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's exactly right. The parable, as told in Mark, and it's pretty well that way also in Matthew, less so in Luke, the parable that Jesus talks about the wicked vineyard tenants or farmers who are to look after the vineyard, it's based on Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard, which you can read in Isaiah chapter 5. There's just an interesting twist, though. Jesus introduces farmers, and he introduces servants. And if you go back to Isaiah 5, they're not there. Well, the way Jesus tells the parable clearly presupposes an interpretive slant that had developed with respect to Isaiah 5. And so Isaiah 5 was understood to be an allegory telling the story, the historic story of God's blessing Israel, giving them the sacred mountain on which he would build their temple, at which they would have an altar where they could offer up atonement for their sins. And it came to be understood as referencing the temple specifically, and the word of judgment was no longer directed against the general people or the people of Israel and Jerusalem. The word of judgment had become narrowed and was directed against those who were in charge of the temple. And I think the ruling priests knew that, and so when Jesus told that parable, and it comes to an end, as Mark says, they understood that he had told the parable against them, and that really angered them, it infuriated them. And on top of that, people hearing the parable love it. I can easily imagine people clapping, cheering, right on, Jesus, and the ruling priests are flushed with anger, burning hot, and they then retreat from the crowds and plot Jesus' demise.
With about a minute here before we take a break, you mentioned these warning stones that are inscribed, literally written in stone, the kind of warnings about the precincts of the temple and how Gentiles were not permitted upon the pain of death. Begin, if you would. We've only got about a minute here before our break, but begin an explanation of what's been found there.
We have found one complete warning sign. It's a large stone, about a meter in length, third of a meter, half of a meter high, and there are seven Greek lines. And it basically says, it says to the Gentiles, stop, don't go beyond this point. If you go beyond this point and you're caught, you are responsible for your own death, which will immediately follow. That's pretty blunt. Both Josephus and Philo talk about those things. Now we have found a complete one, and we found a second one about one-third of it. So Josephus and Philo were talking about something very real, and now we have concrete evidence, as it were, of those very warnings.
Well, when we come back, that plays into the gospel accounts of Jesus' confrontation with the ruling authorities. As Dr. Evans has said, within those temple boundaries, those ruling authorities had the power to execute someone, in particular, a Gentile. Now with Jesus, they're going to have to get Roman permission for an execution. We'll talk about more of the artifacts surrounding Jesus' confrontation with the religious establishment with Dr. Craig Evans after this.
They Were Afraid, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
For to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus, an empty tomb, is not good news, not for sinners, apart from his death for sinners.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon and an Ascension sermon for any size gift during the 50 days of Easter. Make a secure online donation today, issuesetc.org. Thanks for your support during the Easter season.
Do you have a student finishing up 8th grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Do you believe that there's not one error in the Bible? That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
The sharpest arrow in your apologetics quiver. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Over-the-counter convenience can raise ethical questions.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
New over-the-counter tests allow parents to determine the sex of an unborn baby as early as 7 weeks. Though expensive, a 95% accuracy rate makes the test attractive. Obstetrician James Egan points out that at this early stage in pregnancy, women haven't had an ultrasound and seen the baby and probably haven't even told others they're expecting, making abortion an easier choice. Some states have already passed laws banning sex selection abortion. Still, as Egan notes, over-the-counter access like this raises issues many obstetricians aren't ready to deal with.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest, distinguished professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada. He's author of several books, including his latest, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. We're talking about some of the archaeological evidence surrounding Jesus and his confrontation with the religious establishment, in particular the ruling priests and the temple authorities. Our call in number 1-877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you could send us a tweet at issuesetc. Now, you were talking about these warning signs as they appear, and you said they're mentioned by the secular or the Jewish historians and the pagan historians as well as being there at the temple. What would it have meant for a Jew? Because Jesus isn't violating the Gentile prohibition, but he is in there saying things that the Jewish authorities don't want said about them.
That's correct. And that's the frustrating thing for the ruling priests. They want to destroy Jesus, but how? Jesus did not violate the warning, of course, that we were talking about. He's Jewish. He can go past those warning signs and can get closer to the temple. There's no evidence, however, that he violated the sanctity of the sanctuary. He didn't go where only priests could go, so there's no evidence of that. He did not issue any calls for insurrection. He never encouraged his followers to engage in violent behavior. Jesus committed no crime. So what exactly did he do? Well, he did, of course, criticize the ruling priests, but his criticisms were right on. The general public applauded him. They enjoyed hearing him. You could just imagine them, people saying, "Amen, right on, way to go, Jesus," as he criticized the ruling priests and also some of the scribes for being sanctimonious and hypocritical and through their religiosity, showing off, and also at the same time oppressing the weak and the orphans and so on. And so Jesus was, what he was saying resonated with the people, and that's what made the ruling priests fear him so, and that's why they began worrying that his words might, in fact, encourage the crowds to rise up. So what to do? And so that's what they had to look for. And so in the end, when they seize him, they can accuse him of claiming to be the Messiah. And that translates into claiming to be Israel's king. And at that point, they have a charge that will definitely interest Pontius Pilate, who heads up the Roman authority in Judea. But other than that, Jesus' actions in the temple precincts, his criticism of the ruling priest, their deficit as leaders, their moral and spiritual bankruptcy, I mean, in a way, that's something the Romans could just laugh at. And I think that's a little bit of a dimension that comes into play when Pilate, he probably enjoyed a little of that and said, I don't find any guilt in this man. I find nothing in him worthy of death. What's the matter here? And so, that's the dynamic. There's a complexity there, but the only way to get Jesus is to make the political charge stick, that in implying that he's the Messiah, in acknowledging that he's really God's son who will sit at the right hand, That's the only charge that'll stick, because that implies that he really is Israel's king. And it's Rome that decides who the king of Israel is, not some prophet from Galilee.
You talk in this chapter about an apocryphal account that's found in a restored papyrus that may shed light on the real relationship that Jesus was thought to have with the temple authorities. Tell us about this papyrus and what it says, and how it leads us to kind of examine some of these other artifacts in and around the temple.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very interesting papyrus. It was found early on at Oxyrhynchus when that huge treasure trove we talked about the other day, hundreds of thousands of documents that were by the box load shipped back to Britain. And in one of the first batches, number 840, it was noticed that it's an apocryphal story. It's about Jesus going into the temple precincts with his disciples, and they're criticized for not having washed or having immersed themselves, and therefore here they are in the temple precincts gazing upon holy utensils. So scholars have talked about it, and a lot of scholars think that it's genuine in that it describes the way things really happened in the temple precincts, even if the story itself is apocryphal. And one of the fascinating things, one of the details in it, Jesus, in replying to the criticism and defending his disciples, sort of a how dare you accuse us of being, impure and so on, Jesus says, you descend on one side of the steps into the water, and then you ascend up the other side, and you imagine that, you think you're clean or you're pure. Well, I remember one interpreter reading that thinking, oh, this isn't the way it was. I mean, going down one side, coming up the other, this must be a Christian idea or something. Well, as a matter of fact, archaeology has shown that there are public immersion pools or baptistries, if you wish, where the steps are divided, where you do go down one side and come back up the other. And we see examples of this right at the temple precincts, just as this papyrus says. We also see it at Qumran, where one of its large immersion pools is divided right down the middle. You go down one side into the water, and you come up on the other side.
So these pools were designed so that it was quite clear who was unclean and who was emerging ritually cleansed. Is that...
Oh, sure, that's right. If you come up out of the water wet, you're somebody, you've been purified through in the mikvah, and that's what the Hebrew word is for these immersion pools. Mikvah, mikvaot is the plural. And so it was a very important part of the ritual. And so it's interesting that in this apocryphal story, I mean, it's possible, I suppose, that it's based on an actual event, but most of us think it's apocryphal. It really does accurately describe the practices. The archaeology shows that. And so it lends, it clarifies one more dimension and emphasizes the point about how seriously the ruling priests understood the sacredness and sanctity of the precincts. And so for Jesus to come into those precincts, to criticize the ruling priest, to imply that their leadership was corrupt and oppressive, to go on and suggest that their leadership will lead inevitably to destruction, those would have been very provocative words, even though in the ears of Romans, they're not necessarily illegal or not necessarily deserving of judgment.
You also say that the general attitude of the people regarding this ruling class of priests, these wealthy few families that controlled the temple and its environment, is also reflected in other writings, in particular in a pseudepigraphal writing, the Testament of Moses. What's said there?
Oh, yes, there's a writing, and because of its internal references, chronological references internally, we can deduce that this writing, the Testament of Moses, which of course was not written by Moses at all, was written probably around the year between 25 and 30 A.D. In other words, right during the time of Jesus' ministry. And in this particular chapter of it that I quote in my book, the ruling priests are depicted as arrogant, hypocritical. They don't want anybody to come near them. Do not touch me, lest you pollute me. And yet at the same time, they live like princes. They have their winings and dinings and their feasting, and they have no regard for the common person. Indeed, they view the common person with contempt. And so this document, not a Christian document, perhaps written by an Essene, perhaps written by a Pharisee, it's hard to say, reflects the priesthood in the same light that you see reflected by the Gospels. I find that remarkable. In fact, we can add to that, I don't talk about it in the book, but in Josephus, when the rebellion breaks out in 66, one of the first things the rebels do when they take control of the city is they hunt down the ruling priest and kill him, and then they loot his house and set it on fire. The later rabbis talk about that too, and what they say is the reason the ruling priest suffered first was because he was the worst of the sinners. And so that's not Christian, that's Jewish. And it's very interesting in Jewish sources, they look back on the ruling priesthood of the first century. And remember, it's just the ruling priest, not the village priest. They look back on the ruling priest with disdain, with contempt, and with anger. And it's very similar to the view you see expressed in the New Testament Gospels.
With about a minute and a half before our next break, how close archaeologically can we get to those families, in particular the ones named, the high priest's families named in the New Testament?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. We actually have, I know there is some dispute, but we actually have an ossuary with the name of Caiaphas on it. We have an ossuary or a tomb which probably belonged to the family of Annas. Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. I mentioned in my book, it was one of those frustrating moments. I'm finishing the chapter, and then there's a news flash coming out of Israel, and the publisher allowed me to tack on a real quick additional paragraph because we may have found an ossuary, a bone box, with the name of the granddaughter of Caiaphas inscribed on it, and Caiaphas is actually mentioned as the priest, which is very significant, and that's what makes me a little more open to the Caiaphas identification in the first place. So here we have possibly two ossuaries now that refer to Caiaphas and his family, but we also have some remains, ostraca, ossuaries, and other items that refer to other ruling priests. So the evidence just keeps piling up. It's intriguing.
When we come back, we'll talk about how these men lived and how they were honored in death, the ruling priests with whom Jesus had his confrontations. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest.
Hi, this is Jonathan calling from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. On Demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click Listen On Demand.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of Issues Etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Defending the faith, teaching the truth, issues, etc.
I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Another 10 minutes in part 4 of our 5-part daily series on biblical archaeology today. Confronting the religious establishment, Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. Dr. Evans, you mentioned before the ossuaries. One of these, I believe, if I read correctly in your chapter, it contains not only perhaps the bones of the patriarch in there, of this priestly family, but of wife and perhaps others. It was the practice, if I'm not mistaken, to gather the bones of the family sometimes in these ornate boxes, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. And in the case of the Caiaphas ossuary, we actually have six skeletons in all. What sometimes happens is you might have two sisters, you might have a father and a son, so you might have two adults, but then what you might also have would be the skeletal remains of children or infants. And one of the things that's rather sad, I mean, it really grabs at your heart when you look at this evidence. You see these ossuaries, and you wonder, now, why aren't there any small ones? And they do exist, but they're relatively rare. How come there aren't any small ossuaries for children? Well, they just tended to make full adult size, and the little children, when they died, their little skeleton would be placed inside the rib cage. It's almost like being protected. Here's this little child, and he's in the rib cage of mom or dad or usually a grandparent. And one of the things that's so shocking when we look at these bone boxes, we moderns do not realize how well we have it. I mean, who among us starves to death? Who among us dies for just lack of basic medical care? I mean, that's pretty rare in the Western world. But it was common back then, and even for the wealthy, that's the amazing thing. The mortality rate was awfully high. And most people barely made it to the age of 30. In fact, we're not sure what exactly the average age was, but it probably was somewhere in the high 20s or low to mid-30s. And we will find some tombs, and some of this information is in the chapter we're talking about, where there might be 60 or 70 skeletons, and only a third of the skeletons belong to people who made it to adulthood. And that suggests, wow, people were ill. People were, whatever the problem was, suffering. And then along comes Jesus of Nazareth. He's known as a healer, and he is mobbed. And we realize now that's a grim archaeological datum that we've observed by excavating hundreds of these tombs. And then we realize, that puts Jesus' ministry, his reputation as a healer, into a whole new light. No wonder large crowds followed him. And of course, the Gospels tell us he has to get on a boat and push off from shore in order to preach undisturbed. That shows you how desperate the need was of so many, how they were trying to touch him, reach him. We think now of the story of the roof being lifted up so that the paralyzed man could be lowered down into the house where Jesus is teaching. We read stories about how Jesus tries to get away from the crowds, where he can be alone to pray. I think the archaeological evidence throws that into a whole new light.
How certain are you of this set of ossuaries being connected to the Annas family, the Caiaphas family?
Well, you know, I was very skeptical of it at one time. I mean, not in a conclusive way, but I was skeptical of it. There were some scholars who raised some questions about the identification. But I must admit that the discovery of just a couple of years ago that was announced last year when I was writing the book, that we have a granddaughter and that goes on to refer to Caiaphas the priest. That may, and it's spelled the same way, the Caiapha that we have from 20 years ago. And I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't be so skeptical now. So I must admit, I'm starting to tilt in the direction that the ornate ossuary with the name of Caiaphas on it, that probably is the high priest, the one who encountered Jesus, questioned Jesus, whose wealthy father-in-law was Annas.
There are other artifacts, and I want you to deal with two of them if you could. One is the temple tax coin, and I believe, and then the other one is a reference, it's almost obscure reference that Jesus makes to something called Korban when he's criticizing the religious authorities. What are the artifacts that relate to these two things?
Well, yeah, we actually have coins, the Tyrian, as they were known, the Tyrian shekel that could be used for paying the temple tax. And in one particular passage, it's only found in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 17, Jesus is asked, do you pay the temple tax? And does your master pay it? And, of course, Jesus ended up paying it. And thanks to Qumran, where this is discussed, we realize the temple tax was controversial because the Old Testament passage that talks about it is ambiguous. And so does it mean you pay the tax each year of your life? It's a ransom tax. Or do you pay it just once? Well, the ruling priest thought it was a good idea if everybody paid it every year. And it goes right back to this whole question of avarice. And so we've actually found coins that we're convinced these are the Tyrian shekels that were used for paying that tax. The other example you mentioned, Korban, means gift. And Joseph Fitzmyer interpreted an inscription on an ossuary, and I think he did so correctly, and I talk about that, where on the ossuary it refers to all the contents in the ossuary are a korban, or a gift, to God from the person who's inside the ossuary. And I think that's a way of telling would-be thieves, don't steal anything, because you're not stealing from me or from my family, you're stealing from God. Well, that word korban is used exactly the same way Jesus uses it in his dispute with Pharisees in Mark chapter 7, when he's talking about how they declare something a gift to God, and then they can't make use of these resources any longer for their parents. And so Jesus criticizes them, says, because of your korban tradition, you end up nullifying the written word of God, which commands you to care, to honor or care for your parents. So these discoveries oftentimes shed light on a specific passage in one of the Gospels, and that again shows you how helpful archaeology is.
In addition to the ossuaries, which we should probably note are, in the case of the Caiaphas and Annas ones, they're ornate. They're not just the poor man's ossuary, so to speak. In addition to that, what other archaeological evidence is there for kind of the opulent lifestyle that the leading priests led at the expense of the people?
Well, you can find it in two forms, mostly. You can see it in the ruins of their homes. We have uncovered two or three mansions that probably were lived in by ruling priests, and it's just, they're beautiful. When they were fully built and weren't destroyed and were in pristine condition, they would have been magnificent, the kind of mansion you would expect a Hollywood movie star to live in. So we can see their homes and what they look like, and we can also see their tombs. And you can see some of the tombs in the Kidron Valley that are still standing. These are called monumental tombs. They're monuments. But even in the case of Caiaphas and Annas, the superstructures are long gone, and so all we have is the basement, as it were. Nonetheless, we realize these were really great-looking tombs at one time. And so both the tombs where they were buried after life and the homes where they lived during life indicate how wealthy, and I suspect along with that wealth came a lot of power, these people really were.
With about a minute here, next time we're going to, and we've actually kind of tread in this direction a little bit in our conversation about the ruling authorities, we're going to be talking about life with the dead, you say Jewish burial traditions and the archaeological evidence surrounding that. What's in store for us tomorrow in our final installment of our series with you?
Well, we're going to look at Jewish burial traditions tomorrow, and they shed a lot of light on what happens to Jesus. Specific teachings, for example, when he says, let the dead bury their own dead, I don't think most people understand what that means. It also will shed light on Easter itself, which is very important, which is what we're talking about this whole month. And so what the women expected when they went to the tomb and why they were so confused and befuddled when they found the stone rolled aside, we're going to be talking about a lot of things that are very important and go right to the heart of the Christian message and the Christian faith.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Canada. He's author of several books, including his latest publication titled Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. You can find and purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Evans, looking forward to our final installment tomorrow.
Thank you very much, Todd. I am too.
The picture that we find in the New Testament is a realistic one. It's not told in a way. If you ever notice that in the Gospels, it's not told in a way as though these events are taking place with some sort of dramatic music behind them. It's not told in such a way so that there's something hyper-spiritual taking place here. You realize that, wow, almost to an extent that makes you a little uncomfortable, I'll be honest with you, Jesus is, in his incarnation, thoroughly a man of his times. Now, he is the eternal Son of God, and he never ceases to be any less than the full divine being that he is, a second person of the Trinity. But he's also fully human. And to hear that he occupies our history so thoroughly, that he is picking up on things that are already underway when he enters the scene, a hostility toward the ruling authorities, much deserved, that he capitalizes on this for his own purpose, not of course in a sinful or duplicitous way, but in a thoroughly holy and righteous way, that he plays upon the mood of the day. Of course, his goal is not to be an insurrectionist or just to stir things up or to make life difficult for the ruling priest or even to be the moral compass for the time. His purpose is to get to that cross so that he might lay his life down for us, thoroughly rooted in his times. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Come on in and take your picture with my family in front of the White House. Check out the log cabin where I grew up. Let me know what you think of my campaign commercial. Look at Mary's fancy dress. She's mighty proud of it. Watch the Civil War like you've never seen it. Hunt for some of my treasures. And don't mind the ghosts. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois. A great place to hang your hat. Visit presidentlincoln.org. Illinois, mile after magnificent mile.
Hi, this is Pastor Dan Kistler of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Pacifica, California. A small congregation on the Pacific Coast just south of San Francisco, we invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation that He won for us on the cross and now delivers to us through His Word, baptism, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about us or for free downloadable sermons, visit our website at oursaviorspacifica.com. God's peace be with you always in our Savior, Jesus Christ.